It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For the first episode of Food Friday of the new year, we decided to spice things up a little. Herbs and spices are a big part of cooking, and they often take up some serious real estate in the kitchen. But it's easy for our spice cabinets to become the Wild West with a cluttered mix of bottles, baggies, duplicates, herbs we used once and then forgot about. And let's be honest, when's the last time you rotated out, say, that old bottle of cumin? Our next guest is here to get us started on the right foot with ideas for keeping our spice rack fresh and flavorful, and maybe even cooking with those spices. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you open up that spice cabinet or however you have them organized, are you happy with what you see or do you recoil in terror? Do you have some ancient spices on hand, wondering how long they stay good? Do you have a go-to herb or spice that, you're never going to let it get old? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Patrick O'Halloran is a chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small-batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. Patrick, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, let's open up that, say, spice cabinet or take a look at that spice rack somebody might have at home. A lot of people, you know, maybe some spices come and go pretty quickly, others not so much. How do we get started on organizing and maybe purging that collection?
Well, you know, I started this business 3 years ago of blending small batch spices and herbs, and I still have spices at home. I have one drawer that is the Wild West. It's complete chaos. And when we started thinking about this business, I went out to look at all the competitors. So I've still got bags and boxes and tins and jars of things that are probably 4 years old at my house, too. So it happens to all of us.
Now, in my early days of cooking, I didn't really think about, you know, spices and herbs going bad. And I will admit, this is years ago. At one point, I was like, yeah, hey, here are these spices we got for our wedding. And we were past our 12th anniversary by that point. Like, what is sort of the half-life of our herbs and spices where we could say, okay, yeah, this is too old to keep using?
I think most things are pretty shelf-stable. In the world of spices, you're looking at, like, 2 years at max. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a general rule of thumb is store them somewhere that is kind of room temperature or colder, in the dark. You don't want them to oxidize or take on too much light. And I think after about a year, it's time to move on. It's not that the spices go bad. What happens is they just dissipate. They lose their flavor. They kind of poop out a little bit.
One thing I've noticed is with spice mixes, it seems like they sort of decay at different rates, the spices in there. So, like, I can still taste A, but I don't taste B, C, or D anymore. Is that something that could happen?
Yeah, that will happen. And it depends on, like the things that we're producing, we're doing really small batches where we're toasting and grinding things, which if you bought just cumin seed or coriander or fennel seed, that's going to come in a raw form that you could toast to bring out more flavor. But once you toast things, you've activated those essential oils in those spices, and that does cut down on their shelf life. So some of the blends that we make, probably good to use them up in about 6 months. And oftentimes people will come into our shop and my wife, Michelle, will say, I'd rather have you go home with one jar and use it than 10 jars and have them sit in your cupboard.
Now, I follow a lot of pieces of advice I've gotten here on Food Friday, and I'll talk about some of those. One, I just haven't brought myself to, and I don't know if it's really a big deal. I've been told with spices, not talking about salt here, but spices and herbs, you've got that hot pan, and it's cooking, and I grab the jar, and I sprinkle it right over there. I've had people say, well, now the humidity of the cooking and the heat, that's going to break down the spices and the rest of the bottle faster. Should I put it in a spoon, then put it in the pan?
Well, I think, yeah, high heat. If you're searing something like a protein, let's say a steak, a chicken breast, even a piece of tofu or a mushroom, I might season those things with a dried spice blend or some salt or pepper and sear them at a high heat. What I wouldn't do is use an herbal blend in there because those tend to burn in that high heat. So I would use, let's say, if you had an Italian spice blend, I'd add that to a simmering sauce or some white wine or something. You wouldn't want them to burn. Most of the spice blends that we make, you know, some of them are rubs that are meant for that high heat, but most of those blends are meant to go into a liquid.
Oh, and that's great advice. I'm talking about the rest of the stuff in the jar. If I've shaken it over that hot pan and then put it back away, have I hurt the spice that's remaining?
Oh, I don't think so. You don't want humidity going into the jar. So I might keep it a little bit away. But like you were saying, yeah, I wouldn't probably hold it right over the top. Some spices have a little shaker lid that you can just shake it out. That would probably be fine. The ones that we produce have a wide mouth that is meant for tablespoons and teaspoons to go into. So I would keep those off to the side.
Now, for someone starting a spice collection, maybe I just purged everything, or maybe I want a gift for that young person starting their household. What do you recommend? And obviously, it's going to vary depending on the kind of cooking. What do you recommend, though, these are good things to start with. They're going to give you a good, versatile range of things you can cook with these herbs and spices.
Well, with our company, you know, we do blends. So that's what I always look for. Unless you are, you eat a lot of frozen pizza, you know, you want crushed red pepper flakes and you want some dried oregano to go on those pizzas, then go for it. If you are an Indian cook or you're a hardcore Italian cook or a Thai cook, you know, you might buy bigger bulk things that you know you're going to go through. But as a general rule to start out, you know, you're going to want a great peppercorn. You're going to want to grind those fresh because that releases the oil and the flavor of a great peppercorn, black or white peppercorns. With salt, you don't need to grind. There's no difference. Salt doesn't, it's just the texture of the salt. I know there was a phase or a fad where people were buying salt grinders. It doesn't do anything to improve the flavor of salt, but you want to grind your peppercorns fresh. And then I like to go for the blends. So pick out the kinds of things you like to eat and then, you know, maybe look for an Indian curry blend, look for a Mexican spice or a chili lime spice. So that's what I would recommend.
Talking to Patrick O'Halloran on Food Friday. Patrick's chef and co-owner at The Deliciouser, a small batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about buying, storing, uses, spices, herbs, and mixes thereof? Do you have a favorite go-to? You can name names if you want. Have you had a spice experiment go horribly wrong? And do you have that chaos cabinet of spices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patrick, obviously you make a lot of spice blends. How do you start figuring out what combination you want to produce and how you want to get there with the ingredients?
So it really is... It started out with how I cook and a lot of the blends and natural flavor pairings that I'm used to after 30 years in professional kitchens. So I had a base to work from, a core, you know, understanding of the topic. And then I took some of those, started with Italian because I had an Italian restaurant for so many years, came up with a bomba spice blend, which was a spicy Southern Italian, mezzogiorno, which is all those soft herbs, the basils, the marjorams, the oreganos of Italy, and then a super Tuscan, Northern Italy. And then from there, I branched out to a French sea salt with hints of tarragon and organic orange peel. So I started with that base and then I really went down a rabbit hole. And now in the modern day with the internet, as a young cook in the 90s, we didn't have that resource.
Right.
Now I can really go down the rabbit hole and find authentic recipes.
Yeah. As a young cook myself, a home cook in the 90s, my method was called guessing. And sometimes it worked great and sometimes it was terrible. For people doing that sort of thing, are there spices that, you have to be careful not to overdo it. Mine was fenugreek. I tried that one, and man, like a hint of that goes a long way. Are there other spices that are great in limited doses?
Yeah, I think cardamom can be that way. Definitely star anise. Some people really have a problem with those anisey flavors. I happen to love fennel. We actually use licorice root powder in some of our things. But you can find, yeah, some of the powerful Vietnamese cinnamons or gingers can be really overpowering. We have a Thai spice blend, and we had to deconstruct that one, and we found that lemongrass powder was really the culprit.
Oh, there's one spice I wanted to ask about, and this one is being used as a fundraiser, a green and gold blend. Gosh, where in Wisconsin did you find an inspiration for a green and gold blend that's being used to benefit the Vince Lombardi Foundation?
Well, I had an opportunity to cook for the 20th anniversary of the Vince Lombardi Cancer Foundation for their fundraising dinner in Milwaukee this past November, and as part of that process, I thought, what better way to than to come up with a product, a spice blend for that. So we came up with Taste Like Victory, and that is green and gold. The base of that is green New Mexican chilies, the Hatch chili. And then we have sweet onions that are turned gold with turmeric. And it makes a great green chili with pork. It makes a great game day dip, great chicken wings. So that one's been really fun. And we've been donating 10% of the sales to the Cancer Foundation throughout the Packers season. So we hope Sunday isn't the end and that season continues.
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Yes, hi. Hey, great program. I got a question, though. I think it was in 2022, I was reading an article in Consumer Reports, and they were talking about the spice safety, and there was some spices that had arsenic or lead in it and stuff, probably from where it was grown. And I think, if I remember correctly, all the oreganos tested that they had some lead or something in it. Any ideas of where to get safe spices or to find out more about that?
Perry, thanks for the call. I vaguely remember that story, Patrick. Is that something you've been tracking?
Yeah, that's something that we pay attention to. There's different ways of cleaning spices. Some are irradiated. We try to stay away from those. We try to work with small batch direct with the farmers, and we try to work with organic whenever we can to kind of steer clear of those issues, because a lot of that has to do with groundwater and where some of these things were grown. Also, if you find a lot of your spices were grown in the USA, you can avoid some of those problems, because we try to stay away from things, especially grown in China.
Perry, thanks a lot for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. He's with us on Food Friday to talk about the care and keeping of our herb and spice collections as we head into a new year of cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite spices and herbs to have on hand? Is there something that is always within reach of your cooking zone? Have you tried a new spice or spice blend that you really liked or didn't like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about refreshing our spice rack with Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small batch spice boutique in Madison, longtime restaurant chef. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us your spicy stories, that kind of spicy story. Do you have an unexpected spice you like to sneak into a recipe to add that little extra something? Do you have a horror story of adding the wrong spice to the wrong dish or way too much of it? Do you have questions to our guest about jazzing up a recipe with different herbs and spices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Austin is with us in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I don't know if you're familiar with a YouTuber, Townsend and Sons. He does like historical 18th century colonial American,
like old recipes,
call that reenactment. Yeah. And he does cooking, and he had a recipe for a blend called kitchen pepper that like was, I guess, historically used as this kind of like add a pinch of kitchen pepper. And I took the recipe and tried putting it together, and it was really terrible. And I was wondering if you have like any kind of like a modern twist of the kitchen pepper, or have heard of the kitchen pepper and how to like.
So what was kitchen pepper apart from just pepper, according to this historical recipe, Austin?
Oh, goodness. I think it had about a half dozen different spices and herbs. It was like salt, pepper, nutmeg. If you go on YouTube and search for Townsend and Sons, there's all kinds of historic cooking. But
gotcha. Austin, thanks a lot for the call. I don't imagine you've traveled back in time to see this kitchen pepper in action, Patrick, but do you have thoughts on, based on that starting point, salt, pepper, nutmeg, other things that might play well with those?
There's a really a lot of history in the spice trade.
Sure.
And one of the first spice blends that we came up with, we call Antica, which are the antique spices that a lot of the European colonial powers went east to bring back. And some of them were worth, you know, a bag full of peppercorns was worth the price of a home in London. Mm-hmm. So peppercorns are one of them. Nutmeg happens to be one of them. Cinnamon, cloves. And we have this blend called Antica that we use in sweet and savory preparations, which does have black pepper and nutmeg in it.
Huh.
And throughout the Renaissance and that whole age of exploration, a lot of those flavors were used in cooking, and legend has it to cover up a lot of meats and things that had gone off in the times before we had refrigeration.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck tracking down that recipe and making it better this time. Aaron joins us now in Stoughton. Aaron, hi.
Hello. Just a quick story, maybe hopefully make you laugh. A young wife, many years ago, very early in the marriage, knew that I liked meatloaf. Got a recipe from her mother. Well, my new wife did not like the texture of celery, so she substituted the celery, 1 cup, for celery salt.
Hold on. One cup of celery salt?
Yes.
How was that?
I guess that would render that inedible.
It was pretty much inedible, but it was something that we can still laugh about.
I bet. I hope so.
There's a story like that in my family, but I think the meatloaf went flying across the room and hit the wall.
Oh, wow. Okay. Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Now, a funny story, but the question of substitution, Patrick, sometimes it's just like I have a mild, weird reaction to cinnamon, so I have to steer clear of it. Are there common substitutions that you suggest to people? I don't like blank. What can I put in its place?
Yeah, there's always things that people want to sub or they have an aversion to, so we look for those commonalities. Like I said earlier, I find that some people don't like that flavor of star anise or fennel, and then the licorice root is a completely different flavor that they don't think of. If it's cinnamon, there's actually two different kinds of cinnamon. There's a true cinnamon from Sri Lanka, sometimes called Ceylon cinnamon, and then the cassia bark from Vietnam is that much more high oil content, potent cinnamon that you think of in a cinnamon roll. So maybe if you tried the other cinnamon, it would be a little more mild for you.
Interesting. Thanks again for that call and that story at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about spices with Patrick O'Halloran from The Deliciouser, a small batch spice boutique in Madison. Wow, the time's getting away from us. You shared a recipe. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's shakshuka, big, I understand it, in North Africa, featuring a spice that I have known and liked a couple times, bearberry. Tell us about it. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And tell us about it.
Yeah, correct. That's an Ethiopian spice blend, and it's made with all of these warm spices like the cinnamons, the nutmegs, and it's rounded out with a little bit of chili because there's a little bit of fire in that kind of cooking. So we like to combine that with all kinds of sweet peppers, onions, garlic, roasted tomatoes, and then you get that simmering and you poach eggs in there, and that's a shakshuka. Very common all throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, North African, and it's pretty much our family's go-to special occasion breakfast.
And it's nice visual, too.
Oh, yeah. It's just beautiful.
Time for another caller. Dawn is with us in Milwaukee. Dawn, hi.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What did you want to tell us about, Dawn?
Well, you were asking about your go-to spices. Mm-hmm. My favorite spice is garlic powder. Not garlic salt, but garlic powder. I don't have salt in my pantry. I've been using garlic powder for, I don't know, 40 years, but I'm only 35. thank you for laughing a little slow. People overuse salt, and when they salt their food before they even taste it, and all you do is you taste the salt. You don't taste the food that you're supposed to enjoy. The garlic powder actually sweetens your dishes, and it's a great health benefit.
Dawn, thanks a lot for the call. That garlic powder is one of those I buy in the big container, Patrick.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on cooking with garlic powder?
Well, it's something that we use quite a bit. It's in a lot of our blends, but there are some health benefits to some of the spices like turmeric, ginger, are anti-inflammatory. But I want to touch on another point that she made, which is taste your food as you go. As a chef, we'll taste we'll season things when we start cooking at the base, but then we'll taste at the end and we'll sharpen those flavors to see, does it need sweetness? Does it need acidity? Does it need another pinch of salt? But don't just be heavy-handed with the salt. As the saying goes, you know, you can always add more. You cannot take it away.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dawn. Let's talk about that. We're closing in on the end of the dish. We do that tasting round and it needs something. What are some of the most common somethings you run across that just put that dish over the top at the end?
Well, we have the dried herb and spice blends, but oftentimes I cook with them in conjunction with fresh herbs, fresh spices. But more often than not, it's going to be a little bit of acid, and that might come in the form of some fresh lemon juice or lime juice, depending on what I'm cooking, a little splash of a great vinegar, a balsamic or a red wine vinegar, and sometimes we'll make syrups of those vinegars with just a hint of sweetness, and then we'll always check our salt levels at the end.
Okay, in our last minute or so, is there an ingredient, a spice or herb that is like kind of at the top of your mad scientist agenda, your something you really want to experiment with these days?
Well, I'm really, right now I'm working with Mary Castman, who's the chef at the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, on a spice called baharat, which is Arabic. The term literally means spices. So we're working in conjunction to develop this spice blend, and we're going to do a dinner on the 16th of February where we release our findings to the public.
I don't want the full recipe, but can you give us a sneak preview of the couple of the cool ingredients in there?
Yeah, it has a lot of warm chili spices, and it's kind of funky because you mix these dried herbs and spices, mints, oreganos, chilies, with a pickling spice that you make. So it has a really, it's really a fun spice, and I've been experimenting quite a bit with it.
Sounds fantastic. Patrick, thanks again for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That's Patrick O'Halloran, chef and co-owner of The Deliciouser, a small-batch modern spice shop and kitchen studio in Madison. He joined us today on Food Friday with advice on finding and storing fresh and flavorful herbs and spices as we kick off a new year of cooking. We've got that recipe for shakshuka he shared with us. You can find that at wpr.org/foodfriday. And there's still time for you to share your favorite spices or spice blends, your spice successes, and maybe when the recipe went wrong because of misuse of spice. Tell us all about it. You can email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, two big car stories. Find out why auto insurance rates are going up lately and then go back to the past with the discovery of a 43-year-old DeLorean vehicle that's still running without 1.21 gigawatts of electricity needed along the way. That's coming up Monday morning at 8 on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You might have seen this in the news, a big achievement in the world of video games. A 13-year-old in Oklahoma posted a video of a complete, successful run to finish the game Tetris. So this kid maneuvered those blocks to complete the lines on screen after screen until the game was completely done. So far, that had only been accomplished by AI algorithms. Now, the surprise here to me is Tetris has an end. Apparently, the game designers figured no one was going to make it past a certain point, so it just stops going. It's no surprise that I didn't know about this because I'm terrible at Tetris, which is no surprise because the game is all about spatial relations, which is not exactly a Rob Ferret strong point. For me, the end of Tetris came pretty soon after the beginning of Tetris. On the upside, I've always liked the music. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Thousands of Wisconsinites each year get trapped in what our next guest calls financial quicksand by taking out short-term, extremely high interest rate loans. State lawmakers from both parties are working on new legislation on payday loans and other financial products aimed at reforming the lending practices that are often referred to as predatory. Bill sponsors cite a 2021 report from the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions showing Wisconsin payday loans is having an effective annual interest rate of 536%. We're going to check out these lending practices, why many experts say they can be dangerous loans, plus resources that can help people deal with this kind of debt and the potential impact of proposed legal changes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you ever taken out one of these payday loans or other short-term, potentially high-interest loans? Were you able to pay it off in time, or did you get caught in a kind of cycle? And whether or not you've interacted with these kind of loans, do you have thoughts on what they are, questions about how they work, changes you'd like to see in the law? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Orr is clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you start off with the basics? What do we mean when we talk about payday loans in particular?
Payday loans are short-term consumer loans, and they typically come with very high interest rates, as you mentioned from the DFI report. And they are typically made for, 90 days, fewer than 90 days, where people have to pay the loan off within that time period.
And there are payday lenders. There are other kinds of sort of short-term, potentially high-interest loans. Is there a lot of variety in these potentially risky products?
Well, I think there is. And you mentioned what the proposal that is now being working its way through the legislature about changing the definition of payday loans, which I think has a lot of good attributes to it. The main one being that it extends it defines payday loan as a loan with a term of 90 days to 6 months. So it wouldn't mature, in 90 days, let's say. And I applaud that change because I think it really does reflect the products that we at the Consumer Law Clinic have seen people trying to manage. So we haven't seen a lot of these fewer than 90-day loans, as payday loan is currently defined, but we have seen more that are for longer periods of time and are structured more like installment loans, where a part of the payment that a person must make, when every payment is due, goes toward principal and some toward the interest.
One argument from the industry in the ongoing debate over regulation has been, these loans are going to people who don't really have another recourse. Maybe they don't have another option when they need short-term money. And B, those annual rates, well, if you pay it off in those 90 days, those annual rates aren't going to come up. So not a big deal. Your thoughts on how the industry has presented itself?
Well, I think I'm familiar with the message that it helps people who are in a bind, a temporary bind, to pay something that has come due, and you can get the money quickly and take care of whatever obligation has arisen. But studies have found that, in fact, people, once they take one or two of these out, the financial emergency really becomes paying on these products. And so they may pay just to roll it over to the next period and really are not making any progress toward paying down the loan itself. And so I think that studies out there, there's an excellent one. It's an old study now, but it's called Phantom Need, where it kind of debunks that idea that these are intended for people for short-term financial needs. And the other part is that at such high interest rates, these products are unaffordable really from the get-go. Even with the best of intentions of paying it back, or making the payments when the payments come due, the fact of the high interest really makes them unaffordable. And I have seen in the clinic over my time there that they are affecting not only people who are living in poverty, but people who are of modest means and modest incomes.
Talking to Sarah Orr, clinical professor, director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, looking at payday loans and other high-interest short-term loans. A few different pieces of legislation in the works here in Wisconsin that would change how those industries are regulated. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions or maybe an experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned, Sarah, one of those pieces of legislation that would expand the legal definition of a payday loan. There's another one led by Republican state senators here, including Andre Jacques, that would propose putting a cap on the annual percentage interest rates for these loans at 36%, which still sounds high, a lot lower than that 500 some. I understand this has happened elsewhere in the U.S. in some jurisdictions. What kind of difference would that make?
I think that would make a big difference. It might bring these products into the range of affordability for people who take them out. I say, why not do both? Because, you know, as I said, as soon as you take out one of these products, if the interest rate is high, almost immediately you're going to have trouble repaying. And I wanted to point out one thing, which is kind of a little technical point, although the pending legislation seeks to expand the definition to include loans for 90 days up to 6 months, in the loan contracts that I have seen, the people are struggling to repay, the payments are still due every 2 weeks. That's kind of where the term payday loan comes from. So although it might be more like an installment loan where you're making a payment and it goes some toward principal and some toward interest, you still have to come up with a payment every 2 weeks. And that's where people really get trapped.
And then another piece of legislation, and I got to admit this one kind of baffles me as I try to read through it, Sarah, has to do with reforms to wage garnishment for when people have these loans. They, I guess, default on it, and then companies are looking to collect this debt. This is Senate Bill 327. Can you help me make sense of that?
I can. Actually, I've spent time with this bill. I went into it deeply and have determined that really the bill is about making sure that individuals who have a court order for repayment under the victim restitution statute are able to get that court order sort of in a position to be paid back through a garnishment of the debtor's earnings. And so at first I was alarmed because it talked about, you know, a 13-week time period that we're used to seeing in garnishment. But I did determine that I think it will not have a negative effect on consumers as we know it. But I still do want to make the point that wage garnishment can be very confusing for folks. We see people who are dealing with old money judgments from courts. They may have participated in the court process or they may not have. And they may not even remember having a judgment or may not be aware until their wages are garnished. And this is an area that my clinic really is focusing a lot on because it affects so many Wisconsinites. I guess my message is that the wage garnishment process has a lot of protections for debtors, but also balances the rights of the judgment creditor to be paid without really impoverishing the people who owe the money.
We're talking about problems and concerns associated with payday loans and proposals in the legislature intended to help tackle at least some of those problems. Sarah Orr is with us, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School. Coming up, we'll look at some resources available, especially for people who might be in a cycle of short-term loan debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how this all works. Do you think that the annual interest rates, as one piece of legislation would do, should be capped for these short-term loans? And have you had an experience with them for better or worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Orr, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're looking at bipartisan proposals in the state legislature aiming to fix some of the allegedly predatory practices associated with payday loans and other short-term high-interest lending. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on payday lending? Do you want to see caps on interest rates as one of these law changes would tackle? Have you experienced this, or has someone in your family gotten caught up in this short-term debt where they're having to take out new short-term loans to pay off the old short-term loans? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah, I want to talk about resources available. Someone, say, who is caught in that cycle. They took one of these loans, couldn't pay it off. They're maybe taking on more and more debt at high, high interest. What are some resources through your clinic or elsewhere that they could reach out to?
Well, unfortunately, we're not able to do financial advising in that respect. There are some nonprofit organizations that can work with someone to look at what kinds of credit products they are dealing with and how to allocate payments or not. I mean, our message really, when we start to meet with a person who's now in the legal end of dealing with this kind of debt, is that they need to make the decisions that are best for themselves and their families. And we are not encouraging people to not pay on their debts. And frankly, I don't think I've met a person in my years at the law school who does not want to pay the debt back. They really struggle with it. There's a lot of shame attached to this and a lot of pressure. And so, you know, if you can get yourself to a financial advisor, there are some free services available out there to just help you take some steps toward getting a handle on it. We strongly advise that. Unfortunately, many times, you know, if a person is dealing with credit card debt or private student loan debt or debt that's coming from, you know, after a vehicle has been repossessed and they still owe on the loan, that's when people can come to our clinic for assistance and we can help them navigate the process, understand the legal process, and represent them if necessary.
Yeah, we were talking about if you get your wages garnished because of this kind of debt we're talking about, if someone's in a position where all of a sudden, maybe unexpectedly, wages are coming off of their paycheck to pay off those debts, is there potentially legal recourse? Can you make a case that this is, you know, punitive, making it hard to live?
Well, people have a lot of... they have a right to basic income and basic financial protections against wage garnishment. And I say to your audience members that you can take action on a garnishment at any time during the garnishment. And at the beginning of the garnishment, you should have received some papers, but for many people that's long ago. And so if you come to the realization that you are under a garnishment of your wages, please do reach out to my clinic and my students and I can assist you in understanding the process and getting you the forms that you need to do to fill out to communicate with your employer. So the employer is brought into the debt collection process in these cases and the communication goes from the consumer to the employer. But we're, you know, my students are trained and supervised. We're all set to handle and help people navigate the process and assert the rights that they have under our statutes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Matthew is with us in Dane County. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was wondering if the legislation is going to involve auto title loans at all, because that's something I've dealt with in the past. And unfortunately, it's affected, this was years ago, but it affected my ability to register a vehicle, and I had a vehicle repossessed. So I was just, wondering if this was going to be something where they addressed, you know, some of the issues, I guess, the the parallel issues that exist within the auto title industry as well, or if they commingle at all.
Matthew, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Sarah, is that are these auto title loans in this category of short-term, potentially high-interest loans we're talking about?
Matthew, I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Auto title loans are one of the worst financial products out there in terms of trapping consumers. And unfortunately, the legislation does not deal with auto title loans. And so it would not improve that industry or improve those products.
Thanks for the call, Matthew. As part of the story here, Sarah, a lot of the so-called payday lending is collateral-free loans. The bank or the lender won't take away a thing from you. They'll just keep racking up interest and penalties, whereas an auto title loan is against your auto title. There's a collateral there. So does the law look at this as a different kind of lending?
That's exactly correct. Yes.
Matthew, thanks again for sharing that experience. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, why isn't there some type of rule or legislation or something at the end of all these commercials where they're really friendly about giving you a loan? They're like, oh, we'll help you out. There should be a disclaimer somewhere at the end where it says, by the way, if you do this with us, you must pay us back or we'll garnish your wages. So that way, I mean, I know better than to do any of that, but like, there's just some people that are so in desperate need that they're going to do it anyways, but they should be made aware that there's recourse for them not paying it back like they're supposed to. And it should be at the end of these very friendly commercials.
Liz, thanks for the call, Sarah. I'm guessing there's some very fine print somewhere along the way, but do you agree with Liz that there needs to be more transparency about the terms of these loans?
Absolutely, I agree. Another aspect of this that is, happening as we speak are a lot of new apps that are coming out that allow people to obtain small loans, quick loans, also, borrowing against their wages and so forth. And so that's another area that is of high concern for us, because people, feel the pressure of time. And if you're putting something right in front of them that meets that pressure, they're going to get trapped in this. And the disclosures really, either they're extremely tiny or they're at the end of a process or nobody reads them. I can't agree more with the caller.
Liz, thanks for the call. Tim is with us now in North Prairie. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, predatory lending is not appropriate. I mean, I think we'd all agree on that. That has mainly to do with interest rates. But I can't quite tell from your guest whether or not she thinks that people should be responsible for paying back loans that they take out. If they're not, then that hurts the rest of us consumers who do pay our fair share. There's a balance there. And so I'm wondering if the organization that she represents also works towards stopping predatory lending on the part of the lender or rather than just saying, well, garnishment of wages, if they're making a loan payment, that's coming out of their wages too, if they were to be making them.
Tim, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. And Sarah, I think you mentioned earlier, nobody at your clinic is going to say, don't pay your debt.
That's correct. That's correct. And we work with people every day who are trying to do that. And so our message is not that people don't owe the money. Our message is that people do owe the money and there are protections for debtors who do owe the money, which include protection from unfair debt collection practices, protection in the garnishment process. And let's not forget that, if it ends up in a garnishment where the person has gone into court and there's a money judgment and it's being collected through their earnings, many people aren't exempt from that. And so that's how the debt will be repaid.
Thanks again for that call. Sarah, one underlying concern I've seen in all of this is that for many, especially low-income people, they may not have a lot of banking options. They may be underbanked. Banks may not want to deal with customers who don't have a lot of money to work with in the first place. Do you see part of the solution maybe in trying to create other options than payday lending or nothing for people?
Well, I wish there were more options out there, and I wish more people would be banked in the traditional sense. And that's where my concern comes with banking through apps. And the, you know, the speedy nature of technology and the confusing language of technology that people may be getting into even deeper and faster traps. So yes, and I, this is not my area of expertise in terms of market share and so forth, but I really wish that there were more in the traditional vein lenders who are offering services and accounts for people who are underbanked.
And in just our last few moments, Sarah, if someone is in this debt cycle and thinking, okay, maybe I do need some kind of legal help out there, how do they reach out?
Well, a person could call the Consumer Law Clinic. I need to say that we don't handle bankruptcy and we can't advise about bankruptcy, but a person is welcome to call us at 608-263-6283. My students come back in about a week and we'll be able to speak with people after that. And we are also on the law school website, and that address is law.wisc.edu/EJI/CLC.
And we'll get a link up at the Central Time page at WPR.org. Sarah, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Orr, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School, talking about payday loans and maybe some changes to state law in the works. Coming up Monday on Central Time, in many communities in the U.S., walking is not always safe, with increases in pedestrian injuries and deaths, especially at night. We'll find out what could be causing the problem and check out some good news in Wisconsin. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk to a former technology executive about what could happen to the publishing industry if streaming audiobooks start to take over the market. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.